Off the Ball Daily.
A home for your favourite podcasts from Off the Ball.
The difference is that Ali never had that wellspring of hatred towards Joe. Ali, at the end, really was sorry that he had hurt Joe Frazier. Muhammad said to me once, if God ever calls me to a holy war, I want Joe Frazier fighting beside me.
Subscribe to the Off the Ball Daily podcast feed right now.
Off the Ball Breakfast.
With UPMC Sports Surgery Clinic. When things don't move, rotate or bend like they used to, choose us to help you get back in action.
Good morning, Mr. Gilroy and myself. Delighted now to be joined by Henry Winter on the line. Henry, good morning.
Good morning, Colm. Morning, Joe. How are we?
Very well, thank you. So just for the second time in Arne Slot's tenure as Liverpool manager, they've lost twice in a row. We were talking about a lot at the start of the show, Henry. Most of our conversation centred around what they're going to do with Florian Wirtz. But overall, before we get into the specifics, what's your sense of Liverpool right now as you laugh away at the idea of Wirtz?
I'm not laughing at him. I'm laughing at some of the headlines around him. I mean, I've just been writing a column on, sort of slightly showing my age here, but my second year in Fleet Street was 87, 88. And I remember Peter Beardsley's slow start to the season. Oh, yeah. Everyone was writing him off. And then he finished with 15 league goals, the same as John Barnes, who won the PFA Player of the Year. And he really kicked in. And I mean, there was a famous game against Nottingham Forest when Liverpool thrashed Nottingham Forest. Good Nottingham Forest, Clough's Nottingham Forest 5-0. Tom Finney, who was there, describes the best performance he'd ever seen, and Beardsley was fantastic. And that was in the second half of the season. Similar sort of player, similar sort of nine, he was seven occasionally, like Wirtz. And he came for a transfer record. So look, there's always comfort in history, but there's always a bit of wisdom in history as well. So we should remember that when people are writing off Florian Wirtz. Liverpool, you guys know Liverpool. They've done their due diligence into Florian Wirtz as a character. Last two Ballon d'Ors, he featured, I think, this year, he featured between Virgil van Dijk and Michael Olise. So he's in good company. He's only 22. He's still sort of finding his way. And the difference with Beardsley is that Beardsley had other players who were, Kenny was overhauling that team then, but you look at the other players who were coming and doing well. Aldridge was scoring, John Barnes was fantastic, Ray Houghton, came in and was doing well. Wirtz hasn't really got that. Ekitike obviously is doing well. Isak is paying the price for sacrificing his pre-season, and Frimpong has been good, but he hasn't really been played at right back, so obviously. So there's been a lot of sort of juggling in the team, which has affected Wirtz. I'm a huge fan of Florian Wirtz. I mean, anyone who's any experience of watching European football in the last couple of years knows what a good player he is. It's partly the physicality, the pace, the pressing he's not so much used to going from the Bundesliga to the Premier League. But then he also had it from Galatasaray last night. And, let's give credit to them. I thought, Torreira, and Arsenal fans will tell you this, how good he was. So look, there's a lot of headlines around Wirtz. He may be rested at the weekend against Chelsea. I don't know, but class will out.
Yeah. Does Liverpool's strongest team at the moment include Wirtz?
Oh, that's a really good question. I think you start with Dominic Szoboszlai, who's a fantastic player, leader, who, played well at right back, non-natural position for him, but he played that well there for, against, was it Newcastle and Arsenal? But I think they need him in midfield. And it'd be interesting to see if Slot reverts to what he had last season. Alexis McAllister hasn't exactly been flying. Graham Birch's been playing slightly different roles, a slightly more attacking role this season. But I think maybe if you restore that three, you're going to bring more out of the others. He's got an issue with Mo Salah, who obviously rested yesterday. Salah hasn't exactly been in the best of form, but look, he's got options. I mean, it's such a good question. It's a difficult one to answer about dropping Wirtz. The one thing you can say about Arne Slot is that he doesn't stand on ceremony. He's not enthralled to reputation. he absolutely will do it. And he's done it with other big name players. He did it with Salah yesterday. So yeah, it's a good call. I couldn't call it either way. I hope he continues with Wirtz, because I think you actually saw last night, and I was only watching on television, but I was particularly watching Florian Wirtz because I'm such an admirer of his. Some of his passes through the lines, even under pressure, he doesn't hide. You look for character in players, and he's got that character. You look at some of his passes to Ekitike and Frimpong and Isak when he came on. So look, there is a player there. And this £116 million dud is nonsense. He will come good.
Is there also a situation where perhaps we're kind of fixated on the numbers as they're lining out in a formation that is only notional? It's on paper that it's a 4-3-3, but when he plays, they have no width. And it's very reductive of us to think that way, whereas the manager picks the team and the players go out and they're actually responding to the live position of the ball, as opposed to saying, well, we are always rigidly with these traditional three in midfield that we had last season, and therefore if we don't do that, there's a natural imbalance. Whereas actually in possession there's something, out of possession there's something, and at various stages in the game there's something different depending on how they think the ebb and flow of the match is evolving.
Yeah, it's an interesting point about the width. I mean, what Slot did last season was basically centralise the team a bit more. He stiffened at the central midfield. And a lot of Liverpool's width under Klopp was provided by Robertson and Trent Alexander-Arnold. I mean, Robertson is still an important player for Liverpool, as Kerkesh, who's a good left back, but he's not exactly hit the ground running at Liverpool. And obviously Trent's moved to Real Madrid. So, I mean, there's still width in this team. I mean, Frimpong was bought partly with Mo heading off to the AFCON at some point, so he can play right wing. Gakpo, who's kept his standards up, who's actually been sort of one of the shining lights for this season. Also, shining lights for this season. Let's remember that Liverpool are top of the Premier League, and they're going to qualify from this stage of the Champions League. So the alarm bells aren't ringing that wide. But look, it's a good point about the width. But you know, so much of the modern game, you've got players, wingers who come inside. I mean, Arsenal have got Madueke, who can go outside a fullback, Saka as well. We're seeing a little bit of it, but we're seeing a lot of inverted wingers. Doku, sort of a different balance at Manchester City. But look, width is, I mean, I've always been obsessed with wingers, whether it's going back to John Barnes and before. So, yeah, maybe when the fullbacks hit the ground running properly, when Frimpong is attacking properly from right back and Kerkesh finds his feet, his Bournemouth form at left back, maybe you'll see more of that balance that you're looking for, and the wide players can move inside a bit more effectively.
Brief digression there. You mentioned your love of wingers. Is that wingers playing on the side of their preferred foot? So like, you know, Konchesky's on the right wing.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good point. I mean, actually, I would take it a step back from that and say that all kids should be made to be two-footed.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, we've just been voting for the Ballon d'Or, and Dembele got the award. And one of the reasons I looked at him for the award was I just loved his two-footed. I've seen him score with his left foot. I've seen him take penalties with his right foot. Like, you know, one is slightly stronger than the other. But so coming back to your point, I wish most players were two-footed rather than necessarily having to check in and people say, oh, the winger's playing on the wrong side. I mean, I think it's great if you can go outside a fullback and also sort of cut in as well. So, yeah. I mean, look, far finer tactical minds than mine like it when they're, you know, when they're inverted, when they're on the wrong side and they come inside. But you look at a player like Bukayo Saka, who I obviously watch a lot from England's perspective as well as Arsenal's perspective. He will happily go outside his left back as well as cut inside as well. So he's an example. But look, I mean, Bobby Charlton, why did Bobby Charlton, I know we're obsessed about 66 over here, but one of the reasons why Bobby Charlton could score with range from either foot was because of banging, a tennis ball against a garage door in his, you know, with either foot. So maybe that's the debate we should be having. We need more two-footed players.
Yeah. An important point there you mentioned about Liverpool is that they are top of the league. And when we find ourselves talking about Liverpool this season, Henry, it's often quite negatively about, well, they haven't really got going. But we're talking about a team who are top of the summit at the moment. And I guess I'm asking more of a prediction here about how you think it's going to go for Liverpool for the rest of the campaign. Is there worrying signs that they do need to address here, not just in the last two games, but all season long? Or is it just a case of there's loads of new players and they have to find their feet and wait until they really get going? If there are two camps to that argument, which one would you find yourself in?
well, if I could predict what was happening in football in the next couple of hours, I'd be down the bookies, let alone for the rest of the season. I think one thing that a lot of people rightly said, whether pundits or sort of, you know, hacks like me said pre-season, is they do need to sort out the central defence. I thought Mark Gaye not going was damaging, because Konate is a fantastic player, but, you know, he's got a mistake in him. Whereas Gaye, you've seen with his character and the way he's carried on delivering and playing so professionally for Crystal Palace. And a reminder that, you know, just there's a contract and you play and you respect that, and look how well he's playing and look how well Crystal Palace are doing. Coming back to your point, I mean, I wouldn't write Liverpool off. I mean, look, you guys are very sort of, you're experienced, you're balanced, you've seen a lot of football, but you go on social media and suddenly Liverpool season's over. You know, so that's the world we live in. People judge teams, judge players, throw in, let alone month to month. So Liverpool have got a fantastic manager. They've got some incredible players. You look at the strength of the bench. You look at some of the academy kids, or, well, via Chelsea with Ungermar, you know, they've got coming through. His fearlessness that he showed at Newcastle in taking that goal. Great dummy from Szoboszlai. They've got good players there. And you look around that squad and you think, how many international captains are there? You've got Endo of Japan. You've got Robertson of Scotland. You've got Szoboszlai. You've got Virgil. Salah, Egypt. You've got sort of five potential starting players who are all international captains. These are leaders. These are experienced warriors. So, I mean, it's great that Arsenal are showing signs of life. Finally, they bought a number nine. Mm. And Gyökeres is not simply about goals. His work rate, the space that he creates for others. You look at Odegaard. I hope he plays tonight or starts tonight, because I think he brings something extra, that leadership with the ball. They'll be a threat. Manchester City, you know, we haven't even mentioned Manchester City so far. Manchester City will absolutely be a threat, because they've got probably the best number nine, certainly the top three in the world in Erling Haaland. And they've got Pep. Chelsea, they've got one or two issues, but they've got good players. They've obviously finished last season strongly as well. Crystal Palace are doing well. You'll have other teams, you know, we haven't even mentioned Manchester United. They are obviously not going to feature in the frame, but they've got some good players as well. So, yeah, I'm still not going to go against my pre-season prediction of Liverpool.
On the Liverpool point, it's always instructive, I think, to think about history. And we talked earlier on the show about Thierry Henry and Robert Pirès. Somebody came up with the example of players who took a while to settle in. It feels a little bit like Slot is wow, that's a Freudian slip, is that Arne Slot is experimenting at a very much higher level than he did last year. That, as you talked about, he narrowed the team, made them difficult to beat, and then the form of Salah carried them to greatness in the league particularly. That this year, because he has some credit in the bank, that there's going to be a period of him trialing things in games and trialing lineups to try and get to a position where in the springtime the team begins to explode. And again, you look back last year, Paris Saint-Germain were something of a rabble at this stage in European competition before emerging as clearly the best, most unified, most the best identity of a team in European football last season.
Yeah, it's a good point. Your point about Thierry Henry, and I know it's a sensitive subject, and I was in Paris with his double handball to Gallus, an absolute disgrace. And I have to say, your media that night was so restrained. If that had been done to an England player in a game of such importance as that, it would have been front page news. That, you know, we would have been picketing FIFA, UEFA, France, you know, would have been demanding the Eiffel Tower got turned into scrap metal. I thought you were incredibly restrained.
We tried. We tried to be Team 33. We tried.
Yeah, you did. You did. Yeah, your chief executive was quite a character. Yeah, but I'm actually sorry. On Thierry, I can remember his first few games at Highbury, he was all over the place. And Arsene Wenger, in his wisdom, got a sort of group of us sort of journalists who covered Arsenal a lot in those days, and we went and had a chat with Thierry Henry, and he said, listen, I'm really worried that I'm actually going to take out the clock, the famous hybrid clock, with my shooting, because it was so wayward. But he said, believe in me, and Wenger was standing nearby and said, believe in him. So yeah, I do try to bring a little bit of perspective into the debate on this, and Thierry Henry obviously, you know, came good.
That's really
not from your
right?
perspective, but generally,
because I think the absence of perspective is driving many narratives. The back of the papers are talking about Manchester United are scared that Ruben Amorim might resign before they get the chance to sack him, which doesn't really make that much sense to me. It's a bit of cognitive dissonance there if you actually want something to happen. So maybe they're manifesting.
Sorry, it doesn't make any sense financially for him. So it's managers don't walk. I mean, why would you walk away from 12 million quid?
Yeah. But that scrutiny and that pressure, like, if you were doing something well, if you were thinking medium term, you would realize that actually you can't have these crazy knee-jerk reactions to a player playing badly. The Amorim situation is a bit different because it's not knee-jerk at this point after 33 games. But I wonder how often clubs are losing their nerve in the face of social media.
Ooh, this is very philosophical for 8:38 in the morning. I think that we can have a debate about noise. And I think if you talk to players and you talk to coaches and you talk to staff embedded in training grounds and at clubs, they're slightly immune to the noise. Maybe the people around them, family, friends, people they meet in the street, and obviously supporters. And I mean, without getting too carried away, we are slightly, particularly over here, you're far saner country, but over here, we are slightly angry country at the moment, and that spills out on social media. And obviously social media knows no boundaries. I mean, if I vote for someone or offer some opinion, the invective and abuse, quite rightly, because I come up with some nonsense, you know, flows from all around the world. So what clubs have to do, and sensible clubs have to do, is actually look and assess the mood of the match-going fans week in, week out. Those who know the club, those who know the form, those who've got some perspective, you know, like you guys, and aren't just immediately sort of saying, oh, sack the ball, sack the coach, sack the sort of the non-scoring centre-forward. And also, to get rid of a manager, it costs a lot. I mean, you've only got to go through Chelsea's accounts to see, you know, what it does cost. I mean, Graham Potter's moved on from two big jobs, and his children will never have to work again. His grandchildren, his great-grandchildren, his great-great-grandchildren. So, it's an expensive business. And on Amorim, I mean, I've spoken to Portuguese coaching friends of his, and they are absolutely adamant that he won't change away from 3-4-2-1, which, coming back to our old friend wingers, is particularly against wingers, and it's particularly against Manchester United's tradition. So what do you do if you are Manchester United and you're Jim Ratcliffe and you've poured all this money into buying players who supposedly, like Dorgu, like Mbeumo to an extent, fit into 3-4-2-1? What do you do? Unless they can get Glasner in, who can replicate and has replicated that system very well at Palace. Do you stick with Amorim? I mean, look, all the signals coming out of Manchester United are that they're going to stick with him. And of course, the next question is, who would you possibly replace him with, particularly at this stage of the season? People talk about Gareth Southgate. The majority of Manchester United fans want him? Probably not. Secondly, would he want it to go back into the furnace of a managerial job like that? I'm not so sure.
Do you get the sense at all, Henry, and this is just your own opinion on it, that Ruben Amorim wouldn't be opposed to being sacked?
I mean, yeah, look, I understand the debate. I understand the sort of, you know, the financial softening of the fall, but to be an elite manager, and we saw at Sporting Lisbon, he's probably in the rung below the elite managers. You know, when he came in, everyone said, good appointment. But these are competitive individuals. I mean, I don't know many players who go home after a defeat, top players, and go, well, that's all right, I'm fine here. They're absolutely spitting tacks over losing. You know, they are at the top because they're such competitive individuals. You know, you guys are brilliant broadcasters because, you know, you are competitive and you want to do well. And if the show doesn't go so well, you know, you're probably fuming on the way home. I'm sure that's very rare. But, you know, it's the same with these elite managers. He will be frustrated. You look at him and he's contorted. One thing that I would say is that if you are Manchester United manager, there's a certain defiance expected. I don't want to see a Manchester, I'm not a Manchester United fan, but I don't want to see a Manchester United fan not watching the penalties, not being emotionally engaged in what the players are going through, not staring down as if there's a particularly nice carpet in the dugout. I want to see him absolutely engaged and living it. I mean, you look at Ferguson. I mean, I know we always come back to Sir Alex Ferguson. But Ferguson was just brilliant at going through the gears emotionally. He knew when to step out from the dugout. He wasn't always there. He occasionally sent his assistant out. But when he came out, the players knew, right, he's either barking a message or he's demanding, you know, a step up in pressure or whatever. And Amorim doesn't do that. And I think someone needed to, you know, all managers, even the big managers, need mentors. And someone needed to actually say to him, this is what a Manchester United manager does. And I know we're obsessed with sort of image and in the media, but I think he needs to understand that. And I don't think he does. And I also think, and I've spoken to United about this, I always find it slightly surprising with some of the things and some of his attitude in press conferences. I think sometimes he almost gives too much away. You know, you send out a message, but you send out a message of defiance. I mean, towards the sort of the latter half of Ferguson's time at Manchester United, I would tend to go into his press conferences only in defeat, because right. Ferguson was magnificent. He would take it all on himself. It wasn't the players. It was the media. It was the strip. It was the referee. It was the UEFA. It was the weather. It was the price of bread. It was anything but the fact that, you know, one of his players gave the ball away and the opposition counterattacked. So, yeah, history. We come back to history. Wirtz and Beardsley, you know, let's... they're lessons for Ruben Amorim to learn.
I'm kind of drawn to what happens to a manager after they leave Manchester United. Because if you go since Ferguson, so you had David Moyes, who had a real tough few years with Real Sociedad and Sunderland. A second time round at West Ham, it eventually came good despite some of the fan protest. Louis van Gaal didn't manage another club side again. Managed the Netherlands a few years later, but that was that. Jose Mourinho, I mean, he's probably a category in his own, but how do you talk about him? He did win the inaugural Conference League with Roma, but he never drove on after that. Ole Gunnar Solskjaer got the Besiktas job, got sacked. Erik ten Hag got the Leverkusen job, got sacked. Ruben Amorim is only 40. And we're not there yet, but he will go at some point. And I just wonder what happens to these people after they leave United.
Do you know, the irony is the contrast with players who've left Manchester United recently. I mean, you look at Anthony, you look at Rashford, you look at McTominay. I mean, McTominay, you know, he's player of the season in Italy, or 18th in the Ballon d'Or, you know, and he was eased out of Manchester United. I mean, he would be probably their captain now, along with Bruno Fernandes, let alone a starting central midfielder. So, yeah, coming back to managers, it's a really good point. I mean, David Moyes has got a character, a specific character, and this Scottish hunger and drive, without sort of pigeonholing him, and this desire to achieve, which obviously after, you know, he was very wounded by what happened at Manchester United. I remember speaking to him with a group of others just after he got the job, and he said just the pride of sitting in that famous chair in Ferguson's old office, and almost just like sort of, you know, a new kid at school, that he's delighted to be there. He was almost sort of swiveling on the chair in delight. And then the fact that it didn't work out, coming back to your earlier point about Amorim, these are pretty proud people. They're competitive people, and it will have hurt. I mean, Van Gaal was different. I remember going to see him and I said, what are you going to do after this? And he said, I'm just going to walk along the beach with my beautiful wife, and, you know, that will be great. Different end of the scale. I hope it works out for Amorim, because you can see there's a good person there. I think he's walked in, and you go from a club like Sporting to a club like Manchester United, and it is like, it's like going from a local paper to, you know, a national, to the New York Times or whatever. I mean, it's a huge, huge step, the scrutiny. I mean, post-match, he has to do almost like an hour of media briefings, local, national, international, sponsors and all that. It's just... It's huge. I don't think anything can prepare you for it. Maybe the LMA need to do a course on how to become a Manchester United manager, and also how to move on afterwards, because not all of them do. I still find with Moyes, there's still a little bit of that, those 8 months, which just hurt him deeply.
Even when Amrin was the first day out away to Ipswich afterwards at Portman Road, he lamented the amount of media activity he had to do. And a lot of people then, after that was that, they finished that game 1-1, and a lot of people said he's going to have to get used to that really quickly. And funny enough, that's probably where he's excelled most, is being able to talk a really good game, not being able to transfer it. Another guy who's never had a problem with talking a good game, but does have the trophies to back it up, is Jose Mourinho. And there was a parallel of him last night, Benfica boss now, meeting the old Chelsea staff to 15 years ago when he was Inter manager, coming back in 2010 when Inter knocked out Chelsea. And it was this, almost the same guy, just a little bit greyer. But I do wonder where Mourinho's place in football is now. This is only a personal opinion about it, is that like the more jobs he takes on, the more allure he loses, if that makes sense. But he still seems to have a lot of charisma about him.
Yeah, and yes, he's got huge charisma. I mean, you only had to see the sort of the back page previews of the Special Ones Returned. He's still charming. I mean, look, I've fallen out with Jose, and I've fallen in with him. I mean, he's box office. He's incredibly charismatic. We know he's Machiavellian, but there's still a good manager in there. I agree with you in terms of, it's almost like a sort of a famous old band who's going on his farewell tour. But, you know, he keeps on doing farewell tours, and, you know, he'll get Benfica going again, doubtless. I mean, you know, he's got unfinished business there. But you look at the reception that he got last night from the Chelsea fans, was just huge. You look at the control he's still got over his current supporters, Benfica. Well, you know, when they were throwing things at Enzo Fernandez, who left them in sort of slightly controversial circumstances, Jose turned to them and just sort of almost stopped it. He's still got that power. You know, if he was a politician, there'd be a lot of people still wanting to vote for him because of his charisma, and we live in the age of personality. But there is a genuine charm to him. I mean, just, I wasn't at Stamford Bridge last night, but all the stories of Brian is just, you know, the press room steward who retired last year. Amazing character. You know, he turned up for the game, even though he'd retired, with a packet of custard creams, which Jose always loved. And Brian would always put them out in the press room. And Jose, in his first two stints as manager at Chelsea, would always come in and grab a couple of our custard creams. And we'd go, hey, they're ours. And he'd slip them in his pocket as he headed off into the distance. And Teresa Connolly, who organises a lot of the sort of, you know, the work in the press room, you know, he was genuinely warm and engaging towards them. And remember, he lives nearby, so there is still that love affair with Chelsea. He's still got blue blood in his veins. So yeah, there is that charming side to him. But then, you know, he might park the bus or throw the referee under the bus or whatever. There is that other side to him as well.
Henry, you've been great with your time. All the best. Speak
pleasure.
Soon.
Thanks a million. Thank
cheers, guys.
Cheers.
Off the Ball Breakfast.
With UPMC Sports Surgery Clinic. When things don't move, rotate or bend like they used to, choose us to help you get back in action.